Good morning, Your Honors. I am Michael Rooney, attorney for the appellant Petra Martinez. Thank you for hearing our argument today. This case is here after a motion for summary judgment, which was granted. However, that motion for summary judgment came after no discovery, and it was ordered by the lower court in lieu of ruling on a motion to dismiss. When the motion was brought, none of the evidence was admissible. The entire body of evidence was hearsay, and there was no evidence anywhere in any of the declarations that would have qualified the evidence for an exception to the hearsay rule.
What about the public records?
Well, the public records all were admittedly from a private internet database, for one. Even looking past that. For two, the court can take judicial notice that those records were recorded, but the contents of the records, as in a previous case before this court, were all challenged by the plaintiff. So in terms of the business records exception, that's the main one they argued. There was simply no evidence. If you look at the declaration of Eva Tapia at 118 of the record, she's not the custodian of records. She submits a MERS resolution. She doesn't even work for MERS. There's no testimony regarding how it was made or whether they regularly keep these records.
Did the district court rely on the records attached to her declaration?
He did. The district court relied on her declaration, relied on the declaration of George Merziotis.
Where does the district court say that he was relying on Tapia's declaration? He certainly cited the other ones, but it didn't seem that he relied on the documents attached to hers. And we could come back to it on your rebuttal if you want.
I would
prefer
to do that.
So I don't want to take up your time looking. That's fine.
So I can do the research, Your
Honor.
Sure,
sure.
Regarding the George Merziotis declaration, it suffers from the same defects. He's not the custodian of records. He has no personal knowledge. And at line 12, this is all on 151 of the record, he says, I read internal BAC home loans servicing files containing documents regarding the loan. And then he goes through this series of documents which weren't created by BAC and which we can only assume came from another company he doesn't work for and has no knowledge of how they were created, nor does he make any attempt to exempt those from the hearsay rule. So there is no evidence. However, if you do look at the evidence, especially if we look at the recorded documents, the chain of title evidence, first of all, they don't submit a note. The only note we have in this case is attached to the complaint, and it's made out to America's Wholesale Lender. We later have a judicial admission by the defendants that America's Wholesale Lender sold the note at or about the origination. This is a serious problem for the defendants because California Civil Code 2936 says that the deed of trust follows the note, whether or not there's a recorded assignment. At or about origination, while MERS was nominee under the deed of trust for America's Wholesale Lender, MERS's nominee status and its beneficial status and America's Wholesale Lender's status evaporated upon the negotiation of that note, which is a matter of judicial admission the defendants made. Continuing, there's a substitution of trustee at 263 of the record. Problem with this is, A, it was signed by MERS, long after MERS's beneficial status had been, as an operation of law under Civil Code 2936, transferred away from it and to whoever received the note. Evidentiary problem, we don't know who the note was transferred to at that time or any other time.
Mr. Martinez, we of course previously in these cases that you've heard, We're dealing with Nevada law. This is California law.
That's right.
California law has a tender requirement. Has your client tendered the full amount due under the note?
My client's offered a tender, but there's a problem with tender is that we don't know who to tender to. The court can't.
You can tender it to the court, as you well know.
Well, and perhaps the court should have accepted the tender on behalf of.
Did you tender it to the court?
Well, we didn't. We offered tender, and I believe that's the requirement.
You offered tender of the full amount?
We offered tender in the complaint.
In the complaint, okay. Where in the complaint is that? Was it a conditional offer?
I believe the way we worded it was that we'll tender to anyone who proves their right to receive tender, which is not conditional,
so basically
but
you
it's
a circular situation there.
That's right.
But
all we ask
the reality is your client didn't write out a cashier's check and say, here, this is what I owe. You know, basically, it's an interpleader, as you know. Leave it to the court. The court can distribute it accordingly. But at least I'm anxious to have you straighten me out if I'm wrong about this. But it seems to me that unlike under Nevada law, before you get to any of these other remedies you're talking about, you must tender in cash the full amount under there's owed. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't. And thank
okay,
you for the opportunity, Your Honor. One of the civil codes that we pled was 2923.5. Mm-hmm. Under 2923.5, which was later in a published opinion interpreted by the California Court of Appeals after this ruling came down, that case is called Mabry versus Superior Court. It's in our moving or in our appeal. It's also in their reply. The court says no tender is required.
But all that does is to postpone the foreclosure sale, so it doesn't apply here. It's moot.
Your Honor, at the time we filed this, at the time this order came down, there had been no foreclosure sale. We also argue, based on the fact that the substitution of trustee was by a party who was not the record beneficiary at the time, it was void. And under Bank of America versus La Jolla Group 2, a trustee who's not rightfully appointed under 2934A can't transfer title. So to the extent that the defendants claim there has been a foreclosure sale, it's void. It's of no effect. And that's been held in Bank of America. It's also been held in Dymock, which is Emerald Properties. Therefore, it does not cut off plaintiff's right to have compliance with 2923.5.
I understood. I'm looking specifically at ER 168 through 170. There's a letter where, as I understand it, I don't know whether it was you or another plaintiff's counsel admitted at oral argument that the plaintiff had received a letter from Countrywide that satisfied the requirements of 2923.5. Is that incorrect?
That is incorrect, Your Honor. We never admitted that the requirements were satisfied. And, in fact, we argued
What did the letter purport to do?
This letter purports to comply with 2923.5, but if you read the statute in its entirety, if you can't contact the borrower by phone and go through this series of phone calls, you're entitled to two phone calls, they have to send three separate certified letters. This letter has no evidence that it was sent certified mail, so there's a lack of compliance on the record right there. And for two, this is the only such letter that they've submitted, so it doesn't comply with.
So if we look at the letter and we view it as being an admission that 2923.5 was satisfied, you're saying that that's a misconstruction of that letter, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And this was a similar case to Mabry. And first of all, I'd like to point out that part of the record is part of George Merziotis's declaration. It's not submitted by the plaintiff or by me. That's submitted by the defendants. And again, we've objected that it's hearsay. He didn't send the letter himself, and he doesn't know whether it was sent at all, much less submit any evidence that it was sent certified.
Go ahead. I'm just looking at this letter.
So, moving on, there's in the chain of title, No record of any assignment of the deed of trust from America's wholesale lender to anyone ever. So the big question is, at the time of foreclosure, when defendants have admitted America's wholesale lender had sold this thing, who is the trustee foreclosing on behalf of? Who has a right to submit a credit bid? There's no evidence that Bank of New York Mellon had a right under 2924H to take title to this property on a zero cash credit bid on the basis that they're allegedly the note holder and allegedly have an obligation from the plaintiff. Finally, the plaintiff challenged a number of the defendant's exhibits at 46 and 47 of Petra Martinez's declaration that they'd been altered, that she signed these documents on January 5th. And then if you look at the series of documents.
How did you challenge that before the district court?
She said, quote.
Who's she?
The plaintiff.
Okay.
Testified, those are not my signatures, those are forged. These documents are fabrications, point blank. That's what she said.
And to which documents did she refer in that statement?
There were a number of disclosures and other closing documents submitted, I believe, again, by Mr. Mirziotis.
But it wasn't the note and the deed of trust and so on, right?
No, I don't believe it was the note or the deed of trust.
Have like you to. Abandoned your one federal claim here, your RESPA claim? You don't specifically challenge that in your appeal.
Prior to the motion to dismiss, we had dismissed all of our federal claims and asked the court to remand us to state court, where this entire complaint is based on state law in a developing area.
And the court denied that motion.
He denied that motion, I think, in an abuse of discretion. It was the beginning of the case, and there aren't sufficient California state cases. Again, you know, like.
So are you abandoning? I think RESPA is the only federal claim. And are you abandoning that claim now?
It's been abandoned. It's not part of the record, but RESPA was dismissed voluntarily by the plaintiff prior to this motion.
Is there diversity here?
It was not in the.
It wasn't in the motion to remove or the.
Right.
The removal notice. Is there diversity? Do we know?
That may be something to ask the defendants, Your Honor.
Okay. Other than RESPA and diversity, what other basis could there be for federal jurisdiction in this case?
Well, I don't think there is any other basis. If I could save these last 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Sure.
Thank Absolutely. You.
May it please the Court, Joshua White here on behalf of Appalese. The Court should not be tempted to go down the road of weighing the credibility of these declarants or even considering these robo-signing allegations that are raised for the first time on the reply.
Before we get there, Mr. White, is there jurisdiction here?
Yes, Your Honor, there is.
On what basis?
The Court exercised supplemental jurisdiction over the state claims. There's no, it's not in the record that the RESPA claim has been dismissed. And in fact, in the opening brief, the appellant continues to defend a RESPA claim, raising the possibility of not only a RESPA claim, but a title claim.
Counsel, at least at this point, based on the brief to us, at least it seems to me as one judge, that we could say that the RESPA claim has been waived by not arguing in the brief and by what counsel just said at the podium. If we did that, would we have discretion to remand it to the federal court, saying the federal claim is out of this, and now either exercise jurisdiction, whether you keep the supplemental claims, or we instruct you to send the supplemental claims to the state courts? I mean, is that in our discretion?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The question is, did Judge Elsip abuse his discretion in granting summary judgment? He obviously exercised supplemental jurisdiction over the state claims at that time. And it was apparent to him that the RESPA claim was still involved in the case because he addressed it in his motion, I mean, in his order.
Can he deny their request to dismiss the federal claims?
I don't believe, no. I think they have a right to dismiss their federal claims.
Didn't he do so? Didn't they move to dismiss those federal claims and he denied it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. What I think happened here was they moved to remand, and he construed it as a motion to amend their complaint, and he would deny that particular motion. So I think that's procedurally what he did. I don't think he... And I'm sorry.
Well, I'm sorry. Go ahead. You hadn't finished answering Judge St. Eve.
Well, and I will add, the plaintiff obviously had the prerogative prior to the summary judgment motion and prior to the order to voluntarily dismiss those claims so that it was unambiguous that they had been dismissed and that there was no jurisdiction or that the court would have to exercise supplemental jurisdiction, rather.
Didn't the amendment that was proposed remove all of the federal claims?
Your Honor, I do not see that in the record, and I can't speak to that.
Okay, counsel, let me interject a question. I hope this won't be overly complicated, but I would tend to agree with what you said earlier if we could uphold the state law claims. But if we conclude that there are evidence rulings that are error, and if the state law claims, because of evidence rulings, were not properly resolved, and if at the same time the federal claim has been waived in our court, then wouldn't it be in our discretion when we sent the state law claims back to the district court to either say you can now exercise discretion whether to keep these state law claims as supplemental jurisdiction, even though the federal claim's gone, or would it be in our discretion to say now that the federal law is gone, it would be an abuse of discretion to keep these hypothetically assumed, you know, reversed state law claims in the case? It may be overly complicated, but do you understand my question?
Your Honor, I do, and I think you said it best earlier in a prior appeal, which is that this court may affirm on any ground supported in the record. And I would say that the court doesn't even have to look at the evidentiary objections. If Judge Elsip made any misstep in this case, it was ordering the defendants to prove it up in the first place. The claim here, the claim that's really at issue, is whether is all on this basis of this produce the note theory, Your Honor. And it's unequivocal under California law that none of these entities had to physically possess or produce the note prior to commencing foreclosure. That you can decide as a matter of law. And so you do not have to weigh the evidentiary objections, although we would agree with Judge Elsip's ruling on those. And you don't have to even get into whether the court should exercise supplemental jurisdiction over them, because the court did, and the court properly, in the end, dismissed that claim because it failed as a matter of law.
Thank you.
Well, what's your position regarding whether Marbury versus Superior Court moots the action under 2923.5 as to the April 2010 trustee sale?
Yes, Your Honor. Mabry was very explicit that the only remedy that a plaintiff would have is to postpone the foreclosure itself.
And Mabry, when was that decided? If you know.
Sorry, I'll find it in just a second. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I do want to get to the point that you made earlier in questioning appellant's counsel, and that is tender. It is absolutely clear that that you have to tender in full and unconditionally. And what we got here was, at best, a conditional offer. And even then, it was there was no evidence deduced to the district court that she had the ability to tender. In fact, the evidence that was before the district court was she couldn't tender. So that was the that's another way for this court to affirm the summary judgment order is to say, look, she did not tender. Therefore, the claims that are challenging the foreclosure, she doesn't have standing to assert those claims.
Did Judge Alsup specifically ask the plaintiff whether she was able to pay?
Your Honor, I'm trying to recall at the hearing, I don't believe that that was asked specifically. The judge was obviously concerned about her statements and her declaration at the hearing. However, I think it was pretty clear in his order that he found that she had not sufficiently offered or proffered a tender as this court requires, and that is to show not only an unwillingness but an ability.
Right.
And Your Honor, I guess it sets the standard awfully low. If I may now go to the evidentiary objections, all a plaintiff has to do is to suggest that there's something wrong with the credibility of the witnesses, or to say that they're robo-signers. I mean, let's be clear here that appellant says she's not saying that they are robo-signers. She's saying they may be robo-signers. I just don't think that that is sufficient evidence to raise a genuine issue of material fact as to the credibility of these declarants. Certainly, speculation cannot be asserted. And I find it ironic now that the appellant's counsel wants discovery on this issue, because at the initial hearing, when Judge Alsup said that ordered the defendants to go up and prove it up, appellant's counsel agreed. Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. He raised no objection that he needed discovery on any of these things.
But didn't he ask for discovery after the summary judgment was filed and filed the appropriate 56F request?
He did, but I would disagree that it was appropriate, because it was insufficient. It did not address what specific evidence that he needed to rebut those claims. And it certainly did not address the robo-signing stuff that we
see. So his assertion that he wanted leave to, at a minimum, depose the declarants of the affidavits that the documents were attached to, you don't think that was sufficient? That was sufficient enough to meet the mandates of what is now 56D, formerly 56F?
No, because it has to explain why he needs those things. And I don't find that there. And more to the point, Your Honor, it's irrelevant. It's absolutely irrelevant. You don't have a tender, and you don't have a claim as a matter of law. So what claim would this court remand down to Judge Alsup for further discovery and consideration? It's only the quiet title claim that's at issue here. And so we're talking about a quiet title claim that's based on a legally erroneous produced note theory that there's been well over 100 decisions published or reported that say you don't have to produce the note. So what do we send back down to Judge Alsup?
I have a question.
If you don't have to produce the note, do you at least have to show that the lender foreclosing, you know, is in the chain of title, that is, that they own the loan?
No, Your Honor. The Supreme Court and IE Associates, and we cited in our brief, said that the foreclosure statute covers every aspect of the power of sale under the deed of trust. It's comprehensive and exhaustive in its requirements. And nowhere in that foreclosure statute is there a requirement that the entity that's foreclosing produce the note. Recon Trust, Your Honor, was the entity that actually sold the property at the foreclosure sale. That Recon Trust is not even a party to the note. Yet the statute explicitly gives it authority to sell the property.
Let me ask you a slightly different question. As you know, if items are not raised in the opening brief, they can be treated as waived by our court. I'd be interested in your perspective on the following causes of action and whether you believe they survive at this point. First one is MERS authority to conduct business in California. the third cause of action, accounting, fourth, RESPA, sixth, FDCPA, and RFDCPA, the seventh, declaratory relief, eighth, slander of title, ninth, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and tenth, negligent infliction of emotional distress. Is it your position that those causes of action have all been waived by not having been included in the first or the opening brief?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I know the appellant says in his reply, counsel says in his reply brief that he most certainly did raise issues of fact with those, but rattling off those issues in pages 55 and 56 of the opening brief is not sufficient under this Court's standards. First of all, the appellant did not adduce evidence to the district court regarding those issues of fact, and that's why the court granted summary judgment. Second of all, there was no argument advanced in the opening brief aside from these summary assertions, and this court demands that there be legal reasoning connected to the facts in the record and to the claim and theory of the case. And I know that appellant then proceeds to bullet point these issues again in her reply brief. That's not sufficient. And if I could just address one more time the robo-signing allegations, I don't see how those are sufficient to the claims that you rattled off as well. Whether these declarants that were supporting our summary judgment motion were robo-signers has nothing to do with whether Countrywide responded to a qualified written request, has nothing to do with whether it was given mandatory disclosure. She was given mandatory disclosures under TILA. Has nothing to do with whether it was slanderous to record a notice of default, which we know it's not, or whether it caused emotional distress. The emotional distress here was caused by her default and her loss of the property.
I have one question. I practiced real estate law in California for about 37 years, so I'm very familiar with title insurance practice. It is customary in California when you have a foreclosure sale that you get a title policy, if you will, regarding the trustee's sale. Was that done in this case?
Your Honor, I do not know. I would suspect, as you said, it is customary. I've seen that done frequently in my practice, but I don't know to answer your question.
And because the title company, as part of its underwriting practice, would, of course, ensure to its satisfaction that the whoever assigned the role of the trustee to whomever had appropriate documentation to permit it to do the foreclosure, right?
That's a good point, Your Honor, and something I did not think about, but yes. And if I just could close, I know I'm running short on time. It's significant that, you know, appellant never denied that she borrowed $1.5 million from Countrywide. That's specifically alleged in the complaint. There's no denial of that. She's not denied that Countrywide was her loan servicer. She's not said that any other entity claimed to be her loan servicer, and there was a controversy about that. Nor has she denied that she defaulted on repaying the $1.5 million. Does it
matter that this is not a mom-and-pop claim, that it's a person that had, at least at one point, had the ability to borrow a great deal of money?
I think it matters in terms of her sophistication, but again, I don't think it ultimately should weigh this court. What should weigh the court is the viability of the only claim before it, and it is not legally viable as a matter of law. Thank you, Your Honor.
Very well. Thank you for your argument. I believe you have a brief bit of rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, at page 2 of the record, to page 3 of the record, Judge Alsop acknowledges the procedural history of our efforts to dismiss the federal claims. So I'd like to refer the court to that. Secondly, in terms of the court relying on Eva Tapia's declaration at 118.19 through 27, she submits evidence that Elizabeth Mesa was entitled over the allegations of the complaint, which say she wasn't entitled, she was an employee of MERS. They say she's an employee of Recon Trust, and she's entitled to sign on behalf of MERS, and she submits documentation that is hearsay documentation. And in order for the court to make a finding that the substitution of trustee was properly signed over plaintiff's allegations that it wasn't, we would need admissible evidence on that point. and the court did have to rely to make that determination. In terms of whether or not plaintiff submitted enough evidence to prove all her claims, this wasn't our motion. The defendants bore the burden on this motion, and their burden was to shift it back to the plaintiff with admissible evidence that could either negate or refute the totality of plaintiff's complaint. And
Can I ask you to comment on, and I don't know whether, I don't remember seeing it in either of your papers, but there's a case called Gomes versus Countrywide Home Loan cited by the California Court of Appeal this year, which in effect addresses the show me the note argument and rejects it.
Gomez is an interesting case. Mm-hmm. In Gomez, you had a case where you don't have successors in interest. You don't have these four or five different parties who claim they have received this paperwork. You have all the original parties, which I think was a huge factor in the Court of Appeals' determination, because what they said was that on the evidence before them, that the deed of trust was a judicial estoppel or an estoppel by deed from the plaintiff going on a fishing expedition and saying, hey, even though it's in the deed, MERS isn't actually the agent for whoever's named in the note.
And why, just from a logic perspective, my reading of Gomes, what the court was basically saying, under California law, you got this deed of trust that provides all these powers to whomever holds them. You don't really need to present the note in order to do the foreclosure, basically. Is that wrong? Did I misunderstand the case? Understand the case, rather?
Yes, I believe that's wrong, and I also believe it's inapplicable in this case.
Because their note was assigned.
The note was assigned.
The deed of trust was assigned.
And the deed of trust wasn't. There is no public record that says these guys hold those powers. And that's the problem here, is they didn't meet their burden of proof to refute any of our claims.
So your perspective is under California law that in order for there to be a foreclosure sale, basically whoever ultimately becomes the trustee has to have, in effect, a provenance, just like you would an art piece, and show that provenance before the sale is valid. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that under the Rosenthal Act, mm-hmm. when obligation has been transferred, plaintiff, as she alleged she did here, has a right to demand validation of that debt for them to continue collections. They didn't do it. She sent a RESPA letter. They didn't respond. And those statutes create a duty for them, has nothing to do with foreclosure. This is prior to the foreclosure. And this case was filed prior to a foreclosure. We were asking for them to prove their right to collect in the first instance, which has nothing to do. It's completely outside the foreclosure context. Secondly, 2924, second sentence starts, whereby a note and deed of trust. And it goes on and says there's a power of sale, a sale shall not happen until these procedures are followed. It's not a substantive statute. A substantive statute is 2936. 2936 says the deed of trust follows the note. The evidence before the court says that note was sold. The deed of trust went bye-bye. MERS had no beneficial interest on the date that it attempted to substitute the trustee. That's void.
Okay. We thank you both for your presentation. The court will take it under submission, and the case of Martinez versus America's Wholesale Lender is hereby submitted. And that concludes our calendar for the day, and the court will stand in recess.